Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I'm Floodman11, and today we're going to be talking about today's upcoming WEC 6 Hours of Silverstone event. And you guys are very lucky because you've just got me today. Unfortunately, no one else could make it. So it's just going to be me monologuing about some stuff regarding the event and my thoughts, and also just giving you a bit of a preview, I guess. So there's a few talking points that we haven't quite had a chance to touch on since our last episode, which was recorded earlier in the week. One of the biggest ones in the world of motorsport, of course, is the fact that, Fernando Alonso has announced his retirement from Formula One. He's not going to be returning to extend his contract at McLaren for F1. He's going to be stepping away from that and looking to pursue other motorsport opportunities, which is obviously a very big loss in the world of F1, because Fernando Alonso has been one of undoubtedly the best drivers in F1 throughout the last decade or more, even. It's certainly, as a Schumacher fan myself, it's certainly, he was definitely the signaling of the changing of the guard, you could say, from the Ferrari Schumacher eras into what was then the Renault Alonso days, and then the complete randomness we had after that. But I would say F1 hasn't really panned out, especially in the later years, exactly how Alonso was liked. So it seems like it's a good time for him to sort of step away. And as he's made very well clear, he's looking for the triple crown of motorsport, which now he has two jewels in the crown, so to speak. So I would not be surprised, even a tiny little bit, to see Fernando Alonso jump into an IndyCar team next year and do a full-blown effort on the Indy 500. And I'm talking like spending as much time as he can in simulators, learning the car, learning the track, learning the other drivers, doing everything, absolutely everything he can to try and knock off that last jewel in the crown and become, I think, only the second or third person to achieve the triple crown in motorsports. That would be one of the biggest modern achievements in motorsport. And yeah, it wouldn't surprise me for a second if Fernando was able to achieve that. It's, of course, drummed up a lot of hubbub around the world and in the WEC paddock. Of course, I think this is, I'll be honest, I don't really follow Formula One as closely as I should have, but I'm fairly sure this is going to be one of the last opportunities for Alonso fans to see Fernando racing in machinery at Silverstone. I'm not sure when the Silverstone event is for F1. It might be later in the season, but regardless, it does add a lot of drama to this event in terms of, you know, being able to see Alonso for potentially one of the last few times. Alongside, of course, the likes of Jenson Button as well, driving for SMP Racing, and Anthony Davison, who is driving in LMP2. So it does drum up a lot of publicity around the event for the British fans. And I have seen images already of, like, ridiculously large crowds trying to meet Alonso and to meet Jenson Button and to be a part of, yeah, what could be one of his last forays into Britain. But of course, that's assuming that he doesn't continue along with the sports car program as well, which I would assume is unlikely that he won't continue, that is, because he has said that he's looking to expand and enter a extended sports car future. I think Sports Car 365 said that he was looking for, the title of the article is hopeful of a long-term sports car future. So we'll probably see Alonso around either with Toyota furthermore, or maybe teams like United Autosports, who he's raced with in the States at Daytona and stuff like that. So he's probably going to do a Weber and race for a few more years yet. Interesting though, Jenson Button, in an article that was posted to the subreddit today and from crash.net, Jenson Button's quoting is saying, Alonso finally made the right decision in quitting F1, which I think is a very peculiar but not necessarily surprising statement to make. It seems that Jensen got himself out at the right time because it seemed to me, at least as a fan at the time, that he was beginning to find it not enjoyable. And I feel like Alonso has also found the same. He's had his troubles with McLaren, and the Honda engine have been well described around the world and in sports car media. Sorry, not just in sports car media, but in world motorsport media. You know, comments like GP2 engine, etc., etc. He's not been happy with the McLaren Honda and how that's panned out for him. Yeah, I think Jensen is bang on the mark at saying that it is probably time for Alonso to move on from F1. And there's a lot of really interesting quotes in this article. Things like Button saying he's done the same thing as what I chose to do, leave, but leave it open for a year after to go back. So if the McLaren is quick and it's winning races, he can go back to F1 and be a championship contender and try and take the championship again. But he also was surprised to talk about Alonso's motivations for retiring from F1 in a way. I'm trying to find the exact quote. So Alonso said that he left F1 due to the poor on-track action and also the lack of competitiveness he felt. But Button made the comment that as a Toyota driver, he also really doesn't have that much competition on track. He's basically got one other car to be fighting. Now, on one hand, I agree with that because it is basically a two-horse race in the WEC at the moment with the two Toyotas. But on the other hand, there is a lot more variance and a lot more, I would say on-track action, actually, just by being a part of a WEC race, due to the fact that you have the variabilities of traffic, you have the extended stints, you have driver swaps and pit strategy. It just means that there seems to be a lot more going on, even if you are one of the two cars that can win the race. And I mean, we've already seen Alonso at Le Mans be a madman in traffic. I think the safety car 4 hours in, where he just bolted afterwards, he had like 40 cars ahead of him, and within three quarters of a lap, he had transversed through all of them. It was scary. And the same thing at Spa. In his first WEC race, let's not forget, he was passing cars on the grass up the Kemmel Straight. So if that doesn't get your heart pumping, if that's not on-track action, I don't know what is. So I can see the on-track action aspect be represented in WEC, maybe not from a outright competitive for position sort of thing, but the, you know, having to navigate traffic and having to plan moves in advance and having to react to things as they're happening. I can definitely see that being more available in WEC from a driving point of view than in F1, where it can kind of feel a bit homogenous. Again, I'm not a F1 or WEC driver. I can't legitimately make these claims. I'm just sort of giving you my thoughts on the matter. I do hope that Alonso sticks around at least in the WEC for quite a while longer. I feel like he does bring a lot of attention to the sport, similar to what Mark Webber did, but maybe on an even bigger scale, especially in the sort of Spanish market, which you don't really see a lot of sports car endurance sort of drivers really come out. I think the only one or two I can think of is maybe Antonio Garcia from the Corvette team. Otherwise, I can't really, off the top of my head, name too many Spanish drivers who are big in endurance sports cars. I'm just looking at the Le Mans Spotters Guide to see if I can spot any, and none are jumping out at me. So it might be good to sort of try and jump. Oh, Miguel Molina is another one. So they're you know, a few drivers, but it could be a really nice way to tap into that sort of market, which of course is very much into MotoGP at the moment with the likes of Marquez and Lorenzo and Pedrosa, etc., etc., etc. On a related note, on an entirely unrelated note, another driver that we have returning to the series, this time in different machinery, is Toyota LMP1 test driver Alex. I've done it again. Anthony Davison, returning in the LMP2 class to drive with Dragon Speed, along with Pastor Maldonado and Roberto Gonzalez, which turns that Dragon Speed car, I must say, into a world beater if Maldonado can keep it on the track. So that is a really, really strong team. And one of the interesting comments that Davison has said is that he's finding the LMP2 car tougher than he expected coming from LMP1. He's made a comment, this is on an Autosport article that again was posted to the sub over the weekend. He's saying that it was difficult to wrap his head around how the car behaves differently compared to the Toyota, because the Toyota he drove had all the bells and whistles. Anything that was not quite right or not quite to his liking, could use a little bit of a tweak here or a little bit of a thing there, that was all able to be adjusted very quickly in the car because you have all the computer systems, the traction control, the onboard computers, you know, those sort of things, and the communication with the engineers to be able to do all those sort of things right there in the cockpit. So, and of course, you know, being the four-wheel drive hybrid as well, it means you can just really punch out of the corners and drive the car differently and really throw it around to suit your own style. But he's saying that the LMP2 car, the Orica 07 that he's driving, is very different. It's not something that you can do that with. It's much more raw. It's much more, you know, by the seat of your pants. The quote here is more nervous, more twitchy. It's a challenge. That the balance between power and grip is more of a compromise than it is in P1. So I kind of find this a bit interesting that the step down from P1 into P2 is what seems to be a more difficult step than stepping up into a P1 car. A lot of the drivers who have stepped from P2 into P1, especially with this round of privateers joining the top level, you know, you've seen drivers like Renger van der Zander, Ben Hanley, a lot of the SMP guys, of course, they seem to have been able to grasp how to drive the LMP1 car over the LMP2. Of course, the privateer LMP1 cars don't have the hybrid and the four-wheel drive like the Toyota does, but it does seem, I haven't really seen any comments from any of the LMP1 drivers to say that it's more difficult than the LMP2 car. I mean, aside from maybe Heinrich Hedman. On the other hand, it strikes me as very telling about the competitiveness and difficulty of the LMP2 class that an LMP1 driver has come down and said, no, this is actually quite difficult. Although he has said that passing traffic and being passed by the LMP1 class is a lot easier than he was expecting, because the hybrid car just shoots past you out of corners and it's fine. And then the straights, you get overtaken by the privateers pretty easily, and you're still passing the GT cars in the same spots because, of course, you've got that downforce advantage. So from that aspect, I think that's very good to hear, because the last thing you'd want is to hear that it's extremely difficult to pass GT cars in LMP2. I mean, I'm not expecting that would ever really be the case, but it would have been really, really dumb to have heard that. But of course, Alex Davison joining the team this weekend does make that into a very strong lineup. I think he's going to be with the team now for the remainder of the season. I may be wrong on that though. So don't trust me too much. Not that you ever do. But I am really interested to see how he does in that car over the course of the weekend. And I think a lot of people will be, because I'm not really sure that we've seen any factory LMP1 driver take a step back into LMP2 for a full season. I think maybe the most recent example might be Nick Tandy when he won the 24 Hours of Le Mans with Porsche and then stepped into the KCMG P2 car for the remainder of the season. But again, that was before the 2017 regulations, so it might even be different again. Just one of the little things to think about and to watch, I guess. Now, one of the biggest items of news that we've had over the course of the weekend is the release of the 2019 to 2020 provisional calendar. Now, this has drummed up a lot of discussion, and not all of it has been fantastic, unfortunately, but there are a few things to tackle, so we'll go through them one by one. So firstly, we see, I think it's 7 rounds or 8 rounds on the season. So we're returning close to the sort of number that we had before the super season started. I think, in fact, we are one less than the last season before the super season. So one less than the 2017 season. Which is perfectly fine, I think. I think that's a really, really good number, and we should sort of stick at that for a little bit. And the biggest thing that struck a lot of people straight away was that we have different race formats. So we've moved from a standard 6 hours plus the 24 hours of Le Mans race format to a few 4 hour races, a few 8 hour races. One of them is technically a 1,000 mile race. So I think it's, On that aspect, I think it's very good that we're seeing some variability in the race lengths. I thought 6 hours became a little too homogenous because you kind of played the same strategy every time. It was very rare that you saw different strategy elements come to play or different ideas from different teams because they'd sort of all been trained into this sort of 6 hour block. So you kind of knew what everyone was going to do. But the change in format to 4 hours and to 8 hours, I think is very good because that 4 hour mark, especially for the prototype cars, kind of falls into that gray area of do you pit before that or do you pit after that? So I think we'll see some very interesting strategies coming through of teams trying to conserve fuel to save that extra stop or to go a bit more hell for leather to try and gain that time back by using more on the track. So I think that's a good move. But one thing that a lot of people had an issue with was which tracks got the reduction, which tracks got the extension. So let's have a look into the locations. So we have Silverstone returning, Fuji returning, Spa returning, Le Mans returning, of course. So they're the four returning rounds from this season. I think there might be one more. Yes, so Shanghai is also returning. So we have 5 rounds that's directly lifted from this season, the super season. On top of that, we now go back to Bahrain in December of the year, I think. I'm just going to load up the big version. Yep, so back to Bahrain in December. We also have a Sao Paulo race, a return to Sao Paulo in February. And also we've got the Sebring race, which will be a follow-on from next year's race in March of 2020. So there are your 8 rounds of the season. And you've got... so we're starting off in September, of course, at Silverstone, which will return to be the start of the endurance racing season. Then to Fuji, Shanghai, Bahrain, Sao Paulo, Sebring, Spa-Francorchamps, and then end the season at Le Mans. So while I think this is actually a pretty good calendar in terms of locations and in terms of the race lengths, I think they've made some pretty astute decisions here, and I'm actually very excited to see the season as it unfolds. But what a lot of people have been up in arms about, especially those located in the UK, is the fact that the Silverstone event has been reduced from 6 hours to 4. And in comparison, on the other hand, one event that got stretched to 8 hours is actually the 8 hours of Bahrain. So there was a lot of questioning being thrown around of why is Silverstone, one of the more traditional rounds of endurance racing, been shortened, whereas Bahrain, less attended, less renowned, less prestigious event, being extended. And there's a few maybe different arguments at play here. So one thing that has been raised is that, unfortunately, the Silverstone event does not seem to have the highest level of attendance, as high as it should for a race that is the Tourist Trophy, the longest standing motorsport trophy in Great Britain, and I think also the world, annually awarded, I think. I think that's what gets quoted. I'm not 100% sure on that. And, you know, being the start of the season, all that sort of stuff. It's like, well, why has that race been shortened? As I've said, the capacity of the circuit is more than the fans that it brings in. So hopefully the idea is, I feel, that having a shorter race at Silverstone to start the season, A, gets you to drum up a lot of hype around the event because it can be a lot more punchy and a lot more sort of bam. And as a result of that, it can bring in more sort of casual motorsport fans, of which the UK has a lot of. I think the UK probably has the highest density of motorsport interest in the world. I don't think I'm stretching too far to say that. Simply because it's saturated with esteemed history and development, etc., etc. So to try and access the more casual market by saying, hey, we've got a shorter endurance race that you can, you know, bring the family along to and have a, you know, decent day out of it instead of, you know, spending 6 hours. Because 6 hours is a long time. We're some pretty crazy people here, but 6 hours is a long time to be sitting and watching a race. So to have it maybe as a shorter format allows it to be more accessible. Hopefully that also drums up interest in the ELMS as well, as and they continue to have the doubleheader weekend. So I feel like that's one of the ideas behind that. On the contrary, at Bahrain, we know that Bahrain isn't necessarily the most attended event at all. But people have been really unfair to Bahrain as a circuit in terms of the racing it produces. I reckon, at least for endurance racing, especially for endurance racing, actually, Bahrain produces some fantastic racing because of the way that the middle sector really challenges the driver and the car and processing of traffic. Because, I mean, from turn 3 all the way through to, like, turn 17, I think, the second to last corner on the track, you are absolutely flat chat, hammer and tong on the limits of downforce, on the limits of grip, and on the limits of acceleration. To be able to traverse cars through that as well is definitely a skill that should be fostered and should be focused on. So I reckon Bahrain is a good return to the series, and as a TV spectacle as well, the 8 hours makes sense because you start it a bit earlier in the day. You start it in full daytime and then transition into night, which we have seen in the past, and it looks absolutely spectacular. So by doing that, you're not really putting out too many fans by having a longer event, because let's be real here, Bahrain doesn't really get all that well attended. You're adding a greater spectacle for the fans sitting at home, and it is really unintrusive in terms of its position in the calendar. It's mid-December, which there's no other real racing around that time that I can think of off the top of my head. So it is just a really nice sort of marquee event to sort of chuck in there, which I really like. I reckon that one's going to be maybe not a classic, but it's going to be a consistently decent race. Of course, the 1,000 Miles of Sebring is to be confirmed. I think they're waiting to see how well next year's Sebring doubleheader goes, because if that turns out to be a flop, I would not be surprised at all to see that race get removed and move somewhere else, maybe back to Coda, although I really doubt it, maybe somewhere else entirely, or maybe just removed. If the Sebring doubleheader doesn't work, I would love to see a return back to Mexico. I think that would be a great return to the series for Mexico, because that was actually a pretty decent race, and it was frantic because of the size of the track. And I think that was something that was unique in this sort of, you know, Tilke homogenized sort of track design that we've been going to, that has, you know, these car park runoffs and these wide open corners and these long laps that sort of let people spread out. The Circuit de Hermano Rodriguez was really tight and really sort of made everything sort of cramped up and on top of each other. And while it wasn't necessarily the best from a purist perspective, it was certainly frantic and something I really enjoyed and something I thought was a bit different, which was good. But yeah, we'll see how Sebring goes. But the thing that people, including myself actually, have been really up in arms about is the scheduling of these events. So far, there is at least 3 clashes with other major motorsport events around the world based on the provisional time slots of these races. So the first one that people noticed was the 6 hours of Fuji and Petit Le Mans will clash again in 2019. So the 2019 Petit Le Mans is, I feel like it's close to being locked in, or there might be a little bit of wiggle room, but for it to clash again in consecutive years, especially after the outcry from the change of this year, it would be a drastic disappointment for the sports car community, again, because a lot of the same teams and same drivers are commitments in both series. I mean, half the reason that the GTLM cars are drafting in a bunch of untested factory drivers for Petit is because the guys who would normally be the third driver at Petit are going to be racing in Fuji this year. Same with the LMP2 teams and et cetera, et cetera. So it is a bit sucky to have that happen again. I hope they are able to sort that out, because we shouldn't really be depriving the teams and the drivers and the fans and the media and everyone else the chance to be at both events at one, both events for the same year. And this is something that's already had a lot of outcry this year, so I hope it's something that does get rectified. The other thing, the other clash that people have picked up on is the potential clash for the 6 hours of Sao Paulo on the first weekend in February and the 12 hours of Bathurst, which is also traditionally the first weekend in February in Australia. Now, additionally, because of the time difference, the result of the 6 hours of Sao Paulo being on the Saturday means it will directly overlap with the start of the 12 hours of Bathurst. Now, this is something that really irks me as a attender of the 12 hours of Bathurst, because all of a sudden it means that I won't be able to be on everything in regards to the WEC event, because I'll be at Bathurst. And I feel like my criticism of this got misconstrued in the provisional calendar reveal thread on the Reddit in the comments. I was initially very frustrated and a bit wound up about it, because I, you know, because it kind of triggered an emotional reaction. Like, why is this event why are these events clashing? And I feel like the reason I got so wound up about it is that there's like four major GT events that you should really avoid, right? There's the Nürburgring 24 hour, there's the Bathurst 12 hour, there's the Spa 24 hour, and you could throw in, depending on your classification of it, Daytona or even like the Gulf 12 hour, Dubai 24, you know, those sort of things, those big name GT events, you want to kind of avoid, and you know when they're going to be. That's the issue I have with it, is you know when they're going to be every year, because they have built up that date equity to say, okay, Bathurst is going to be the first weekend of February. Spa 24 is going to be the last weekend of July. Le Mans is the third weekend of June every single year. And so you know when these events are going to happen. So why then would you schedule an event on the other side, like regardless of where it is, that intrudes on the same market, like the same target market of sports car endurance fans, on the same weekend as one of those already established sort of events? It just strikes me as poor planning. And honestly, a little disrespectful. Now, I know that there's commercial aspects to this as well. You know, there might be other track days, or there might be remodeling of the track, and you know, this is the only weekend that they can do it, or they're trying to capitalize on something. Like, from what I've heard, the 6 hours of Sao Paulo is going to be on that weekend to try and capitalize on a festival that's happening in the city at the time, which makes sense from a business perspective, but on the other hand, it does sort of throw a spanner into the works for the people who are going to try and be following both, like me, and who the teams who want to be going both, and the drivers who want to be doing both, and the media who wants to be doing both. Like, I can't imagine what it must be like for RLM on weekends, like this weekend, for example, where they have Silverstone, VLN, and IMSA in the same weekend. Like, it must just be an absolute logistical disaster. And then you multiply that for an event like, for a WEC event and the 12 Hours of Bathurst, which is another big marquee GT event, which needs, you know, a similar level of coverage. And like, I don't know how people like Sportscar 365, John Daggus, or Daily Sportscar are really going to be able to do it. It's going to be real interesting. And as a fan, I'm disappointed, and I hope that the provisional calendar doesn't quite end up to be exactly the same as the final calendar. I hope there is an effort made to sort of move these events around to sort of try and find a bit more room in the schedule. Especially because, like, I want to be at Bathurst. I want to see these drivers that drive in the WEC that come for this event. I want to meet, like, I totally feel it's Acosta and Augusto Farfus, who, when I met him at Bathurst, said that this was the craziest track he's ever driven, and he was absolutely enamored by the event and thought it was the coolest thing ever. I want to talk to Paul Dallalana again. I want to talk to him about his Aston Martin and his Canadian liveried Audi and how he goes in the championship. And he was having a ball when I ran into him and, you know, recognized him and was talking to him about his exploits. Like, I want to see these drivers be able to make the trip to Bathurst and participate in that event. It might be for selfish reasons, but hey, I'm allowed to be, right? Everyone's allowed to be a little bit selfish. Finally, the last notable clash, there's one or two other clashes. I feel like one of them, I think it might be Bahrain, actually clashes with the Gulf 12 Hour, which is a bit less of a big name event. I doubt you'd see many of the WEC teams and drivers be racing in the Gulf 12 Hour. So I'm not too concerned about that. I know for the guys like maybe Chris Washer or X-Voss, some of the guys who are more into the Creventic and GT3 racing, they might be a bit irked by that, but I'm personally not too irked. But the final one that could potentially rear its head is a clash between the 24 Hours of Le Mans test day and the 24 Hours of Nürburgring. Now, that would be a major breakdown in communication between the ADAC GT organizers and the Le Mans, the ACO. Because a lot of those drivers do both events. A lot of those teams try and do both events. Like Manti run the VLN cars and also run the WEC GT cars for Porsche. So those are going to be big names that are going to be missing from the entry list and the drivers, of course. And it's going to just make it, a bit more difficult to stay on top of both. I guess it's less problematic than the Nürburgring 24 clashing with the Blank Pan race, because that is actually a big problem, because those are entirely overlapping teams and drivers. So you have to kind of make a choice of, do you want a Blank Pan GT challenge or do you want to race at Nürburgring? So that one's a bit of a mess. But yeah, so as I mentioned already, I hope the provisional calendar doesn't necessarily reflect the final calendar, because I want these clashes to be sort of addressed. Not necessarily because I'm trying to get up on my high horse and be all elitist and entitled and whatever. It's because I want to see all these events succeed, and I think the best way for that to happen is for them to separate themselves from each other, at least by a week, to let the drivers and the fans be able to process each of these as they come, instead of having it all happen in one weekend. Because when you're competing for the same market share, you're going to lose out in the end. Of course, it may depend on, like, commercially, it may depend on how many people you can get in the gates versus how many people you can get watching. So, I mean, for an event like Bathurst, that's very much a, you need people to be watching, because Bathurst itself is a relatively remote town in a relatively remote state in a very remote country. So you really need a lot of advertising money commercially from people watching the stream. I feel, at least. I have no insight into the inner workings of the series at all, but I feel like that would be one of the best ways for them to be gaining that interest. And, like, let's not forget, Bathurst is literally the fastest growing GT3 race in the world. So I would hate to see a hiccup in that because of a clash with a bigger event, which is a bit annoying. But hey, I actually think that this calendar, this 8-round calendar, is a pretty decent one as a starting point for what we could see the WEC become. I reckon in maybe 5 years, we might see a 10-round season with a few more races dotted around. I would be surprised if we don't return to the Nürburgring at some point, or Autodromo Hermanos Rodriguez in Mexico. And here's a hot take for you. I reckon that within 5 years, we're going to see a WEC or similarly large GT endurance race at the Bend in South Australia. Now, the reason I say that is because of the fact that the facilities have been specifically made to be able to cater for this type of racing with a 7.7-kilometer track. And, you know, there's been interest around the event, around a potential event there. It was asked in the motorsport survey, the really bad one from a few years ago. And it looks like, and from what I've been hearing around the organization of the track and whatever, they're really pushing for it. So I reckon we might see an Australian round of the WEC in a few years' time. And also, I really want one because that's literally up the road for me. I'm actually heading there next weekend to do marshalling for the V8s for the first time. So it's going to be good. People should watch that because that's going to be a good track. Anyway, back to Silverstone. So let's give you just a quick wrap-up of the event. So the event so far has been a very good one, I think, especially with the ELMS. The ELMS race, I didn't catch most of the ELMS race, but qualifying itself was an absolute, like, crazy festivity of lap times tumbling. It was amazing just to be watching the timing screens for me. And again, with the qualifying for the WEC as well. But the weekend started on a pretty sour note for the Rebellion number one car. Early on in practice one, Bruno Senna had a light clash with, I think it was a GTAM car coming out of the pits on one of his opening laps. So they returned the car to the garage, fixed it up and sent it back out again. And then on that very next lap, he had a big lose in Cop's corner on the exit and basically plowed the car into the wall there. So hard that he's broken, I think it's broken his ankle. So that is not the way that Rebellion would have wanted to start their weekend. Definitely not the way that Bruno Senna would have wanted to be spending his weekend. And that damaged the car to the point that they lost all of the rest of their Friday running and were only able to get the car back out on Saturday to do FP3 and qualifying. And Bruno Senna, of course, is missing out the rest of the weekend with a broken foot. That has kind of added to a little bit of a testing time for Rebellion because they haven't quite been the class of the privateer field like they were at Spa and at Le Mans. It seems, at least from the practice times and from qualifying, definitely from qualifying, that the BR1 engineering cars, sorry, the BR engineering cars, the S&P racing cars, have the measure of Rebellion. In qualifying, it was only around 2 or 3 tenths, but I think that gap is maybe artificially smaller due to the fact that we had that late red flag, which meant that the likes of Button and Oruzadev had to abort their laps, and it meant that I think Oruzadev only very just got his last lap in after the checkered flag and was very conservative of it because he got one or two laps deleted from his time due to track limits, which is something we saw actually throughout the field. I think at one point there was a single car in the GTAM field that didn't get a lap deleted for track limits abuse, and that was the pole sitting car of Team Project One, which I might just want to, by the way, say really impressive to see that car get on pole, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So in LMP1, it seems like the pecking order is now Toyota, by a clear 2 seconds on a clear lap. They're just untouchable yet again, and no one really is expecting anything else. But then it seems like S&P Racing have the edge over Rebellion, and then Dragon Speed and Bicolors are kind of battling it out for that last position. It's a shame that Manor couldn't be here, of course, because, and of course, even more so with it being their home event and that sort of thing, it is a real shame to not see them there, but I do, fingers crossed, hope we see them in Fuji, and I hope that what I said in the last podcast doesn't come true. I hope the wheels don't fall off and they don't ever return, because that would be a real punch in the gut to the LMP1 privateer program for everyone. Interest around the entire class would just go down, and especially that interest in Britain, which, again, I think is one of the biggest markets that the WEC really needs to focus on. So if the British team falls apart and doesn't make any other rounds, it would be a real black mark against the series, which I hope doesn't come to fruition. LMP2, the qualifying session was extremely interesting, but the best part about LMP2 at the moment is it could really go anywhere. There are so many teams that have the metal and the skill to be able to put their car in a good position, and it will very much come down to who makes the right call at the right time with the right driver, on the right tires as well, to see where that class ends up come race day. It was very surprising in the qualifying session for me. I didn't really have a massively close look at practice, but it was very surprising to me that both Jackie Chan DC cars were 1 and 2 in the field for qualifying. And not only that, they were a full second ahead of the next best car. I'm not sure why that was, but JCDC must have just unlocked something at this circuit that no one else was able to, because they blew everyone away from in that qualifying session. And it was off of the backs of laps by, I think it's Jasmine Jafar and Hoping Tung in each of those cars that really just were shockingly brilliant. They were the best two laps of the entire field, and then the amateur drivers as well. Jeffrey and Aubrey, I believe, are the two amateurs in those cars. They were on par with the best of the professionals, which kind of strikes me as a little odd, but I'm willing to kind of go with it. I feel like maybe they were their first running lap on those tires. I didn't catch qualifying. I wasn't super focused on qualifying. I was just kind of had it running in the background because I was at work. But if they used the set of tires to set that lap, or if they'd set that lap and not had it deleted for track limits and they set it before the red flag came out, that might explain some of that discrepancy. But I think a difference between of 2 seconds between Pierre Thierrier and Nabil Jeffrey, just that doesn't sound right to me. So I'm going to keep a close eye on the first part of that race just to sort of make sure that nothing afoul is going on, because that, again, that doesn't really smell right. But on the other hand, you have Alpine right in the mix. You have TDS Racing in the mix as well. And TDS Racing, after their still pending disqualification from Le Mans, would be looking to definitely get back on level terms. And just quickly, if you had that as a Fantasy WEC pick, that was a pretty good pickup for how cheap it was, right? Right? Fingers crossed, right? I think the only team that is straight up not going to have a chance for the LMP2 class is Labra. I think the quality of all the other teams show at least some level of competitiveness, but Labra just, they were 2 seconds off the lowest part of the LMP2 field in qualifying, and that was 5 seconds from the lead. So read into that what you will. I'll be interested to see how Nick De Vries goes in the Racing Team Netherlands car, if he's able to adequately better Jan Lammers. That might become a quite interesting competitor. Dragon Speed in qualifying was the funniest stuff I think I've ever seen. Pastor Maldonado took 13 and a half minutes to set a single lap that wasn't deleted for track limits abuse or going off the track in high speed incidents. 13 and a half minutes in a 20-minute session. He was very lucky for them that the red flag came out when it did, for Van Erd's sort of off at cops, because it basically gave them a free kick to get their second driver straight in the car without losing any time. So that was lucky for them, but it still didn't do them all too well. I mean, they only qualified 14th out of the 15-car LMP field. LMP2 is going to be really interesting. It's a shame that the class has been reduced now to 7, with the G-Drive car taking its sabbatical to the ELMS. But it should still be a competitive race, especially considering the quality of 6 of the 7 teams. Moving down to GT, and GTE Pro is looking quite tasty and also extremely interesting, because we have a few different suspects at the top of the field, namely the Aston Martin Racing Vantage. It's a thing that exists because we saw it for once, not like Le Mans where we didn't see it at all. This car actually exists, and it actually looks like it's going to be quick. Now, they did get a pretty substantial balanced performance break. But someone was saying, I think someone posted on the sub, I think it was Maxime Martin, the improvement is not just, quote, not just down to BOP. I mean, it certainly looks like that, though. It certainly looks like the BOP really gave them a free kick. And I want to say, I don't know what I want to say. I hope that this is a sign of competitiveness, but I don't want them to just kind of be getting handouts from the organizers for this for the balanced performance. I hope that we see the Aston Martins, along with the AF Corsa Ferraris and the BMW cars, get into that more competitive bracket, because like we saw at Le Mans and like we saw at Spa, it did kind of become the Ford and Porsche show. On that note, Ford did take the pole position through Stefan Mucha and Olivier Pla. Then the next two cars were the two Aston Martins, followed by the second Ford, and then the first of the Porsches. Now, the Porsches had a pretty torrid qualifying session, with laps getting deleted and the red flag coming out and traffic. It was just a bit crap all around from then. So I feel like there's more pace in that car come the race. As far as the Ferrari and the BMW goes, maybe not so much. Maybe not so much in that section, especially the BMW, which really disappoints me because I picked that for my fantasy WEC, and that makes me real annoyed. But I don't think the setup of the car is really conducive to a track like Silverstone, maybe. I think, you know, because boats take a bit more to steer. We'll see what comes out of that class, and it should be competitive either way. I just hope it doesn't turn into another Noah's Ark type deal. However, the gaps between first in class and last in class in terms of qualifying was just over a second, which is pretty tight when you consider it's almost a 2-minute lap and you're running on one set of tires, basically. So I think we'll see some level of competitiveness, hopefully not Noah's Ark. Now, finally, GTEM, it was a really, really cool pole position from Team Project One on their first year in the WEC to take a pole position at Silverstone. And it was a really classy pole as well. As I said, they didn't have a lap deleted for track limits, and they played the strategy really interesting, because there is a strategy to qualifying in the Pro-Am classes, because you have to decide whether you want to send out your pro on the fresh tires to set a blinder and then try and coach your AM through setting a decent lap on a set of old tires, or use your AM with the brand new tires to set a good lap and then try and compensate for the loss by getting a better lap with your pro than what an AM could do on the old tires, a much better lap. And that's the strategy that Project One went with. They had Perfetti put in a pretty decent lap on the fresh tires, and of course it was his first lap on as well, so he's getting the maximum out of those tires. He put in a 59.4, which, you know, it wasn't fantastic. It's not, you know, a blinding lap, but it was the best of the amateurs by a long way. The next best amateur driver to put in the lap was Christian Reed, and that was it wasn't Christian Reed. Let me just scan here quickly. It was Sally Yolok in the TF Sport car, which was just under a second behind. And he was much better than the other driver who did that plan of putting the AM in with the fresh tires, which was Wang Sung Mok, I think. Let me just double check that. Yes, it was. So Mock put in a 201.9, so a good 2.5 seconds off of that lap by Perfetti, which is a really good lap. And so Bergmeister was able to get in the car, put in a 58.5, which is still a pretty decent lap. It would have been third to last out of the pros, but the fact that they lost relatively little time with their amateur meant that they were able to put the car on pole position. Again, a lot of this is to do with not getting their lap deleted, so they were able to use the tire at their maximum. Next best car was a late lap from Christian Reed, put the 77 car into second place, which also had the fastest time of anyone. Yep. So the 57.9 from Andlauer, I believe, was the fastest time in qualifying for them. And then TF Sport and AMR, the next two cars, before the next Dempsey Proton Porsche, and then the spring of Ferraris before Golf Racing brought up the rear. So it's good to see that the Aston Martins are being competitive in both the Pro and AM class. Now, I'd keep a pretty good eye on them for the race, especially considering it is Silverstone, is the home event for the Aston Martin. So I would expect them to be more in the spotlight than they were at, say, Le Mans. Just to wrap up all of this, there was a very interesting quote from Jenson Button again. He seems to be everywhere this weekend, really enjoying the WC spotlight. He said that Toyota are so far ahead in terms of the equivalence of technology and the fact that they are able to use their hybrid to pass slower class cars and are just plain better resourced and better prepared than the SMP guys and the Rebellion guys, that he said they will be four laps ahead by the end of the race. Now, they were two laps ahead at the end of Spa with a little bit of restriction from a few full course yellows and safety cars, but also remember that the Rebellions ran into a lot of troubles at Spa-Francorchamps, which meant that the gap might have been artificially lengthened. I mean, Conway was able to walk. The number seven car, apologies, was able to come from two laps down, basically, and still end up fighting for the lead. So that kind of tells you how restricted the front of the race was. So I think four might be a bit of a stretch. I'm going to say three laps, I reckon. I reckon the Toyota cars will win by three laps over the next place privateer. And I reckon that privateer is going to be either the number 17 or the number 11. I reckon SMP, in this high downforce kit, let's not forget, have the measure of Rebellion so far, especially as Rebellion has said that they're looking to kind of get through the weekend after Senna's crash. So I reckon SMP are going to be in the box seat to take a podium position, which would be fantastic for the team and for the project. It really does show that the preparedness of the project and of Dallara and of BR Engineering has results and will come to fruition. Now, it's a matter of which SMP racing car do you pick. I personally went with the 11, I think, because it was cheaper in Fantasy WC, pretty much. So I reckon the privateer battle between SMP and Rebellion is really going to ramp up from this point in the season, and I'll be very interested to see how that goes. As far as LMP2, I'm going to stick with Alpine, simply because they've now taken a Le Mans victory again, and the likes of Thierry Nagrao and Lapierre, that is still a power lineup, and I don't think the likes of TDS or Jackie Chan DC, I don't think Jackie Chan DC has the metal to be able to stick with the top, at least with these drivers. Last year they were basically impervious for most of the season, but with these drivers, I feel like they're a little too inexperienced on this stage to be able to really close out a race result. And, you know, watch them prove me wrong and stonk away to a lap and a half winning finish. If it is going to be a JCDC car, it would be the 38, but I still reckon the 36 is going to be the one to beat. As I said, I'm going to be interested to see how the 31 does with Anthony Davison behind the wheel, along with Paston Maldonado and Roberto Gonzalez. Again, of course, as long as Maldonado doesn't put it in the wall or into another car or in somewhere else. GTE Pro is going to be a very interesting one. I think based on the times we've seen in practice and qualifying, it's going to be Ford which has the biggest strength in order to win the race. But the fact that Aston Martin and Porsche, I still think Porsche has a bit more pace in that car. I don't reckon their 5th and 10th in class is representative of their actual pace. So I reckon Porsche maybe would be able to get a podium. But I reckon Aston Martin is going to be the team that's most likely to get Ford off their throne. But I still think Ford is going to have the upper hand. Finally, in GTEM, who knows what's going to happen in GTEM. Project 1 was a surprise pole position for me. I hope they continue that into the race. I honestly, like, I'm going to pick the 77 because patriotic connection with Matt Campbell, and also they're coming off a Le Mans win, and also Christian Reed just won the ELMS race at the Red Bull Ring as well, which is the first win outside of Le Mans for that car. So, like, that's what I'm going to go with. I don't 100% believe it, but I guess. It's a very difficult class to pick because there is just a very nice level of competitiveness. Now, I was going to ask if anyone had any questions for me, but there's no one here, so I guess I'll just save those questions for another time. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you enjoy the race. We'll see you there. Thank you very much. Peace.